like to return to the statement that Yahuwah conveyed in writing through a prophet named Embrace This, Chabaouk, Habakkuk, and in the way it's been transliterated in your Bible, if you would like to look this up. We were considering the entirety, really, of the first and second chapters. We were in the 18th statement of the second chapter yesterday. And it was just so powerfully enlightening as it relates to the tactic that Paul used to create Christianity. It drives right to the heart of the problem. And it conveys everything you need to know about Paul and about the Christian Jesus Christ and about the God's view of the religion that Paul created around the Christian Jesus Christ. All there in one statement. And, well, I'm going to go over the statement again, even though we spent an hour on it yesterday. It's important that you keep in mind that this statement is in the context of the most explicit, the most detailed, the most important prophecy that God ever provided. It is a prophecy that tells us that a single male individual would arrive at the time the Moed are being fulfilled. That was in 33 CE, year 4000 Yah. That his focus would be on Gentiles, which is precisely what Paul's focus was. And Paul, by the way, when the Moed were being fulfilled, was a student learning to be a rabbi in Jerusalem, same place the Moed were fulfilled. That he would be enormously egotistical. When you read Paul's letters, he is just, not only is his ego unbridled, he even tells us that his ego was so out of control that Satan, by possessing him, is the only one that can control his ego. Said that this man would use circular reasoning, that he would be wholly adverse to the very requirements to participate in the covenant and responsibilities of Yahweh relative to what he promised to do in fulfilling the benefits of the covenant through the Moed, that he would be wholly adverse to those things. And then he told us that this man's name would be Shaul, which is Paul's given name. Paul admits it twice. He says, you know, my birth name was Shaul, that his name will be Shaul. And he even goes into detail about who Yahweh will put in place to refute him initially. Twice he mentions the rock. The rock is both the name Yahweh gave to Shimon Kephish, known to us as Peter, meaning Greek for rock, who brought him to the Jerusalem summit to accuse him, refute him, whom Paul resolutely condemns in his first letter, one written exactly 666 years after Yahweh issued this prophecy against Paul, but also the rock of our salvation, which is Yahusha, and he condemned Paul vociferously, not only in the Sermon on the Mount, but also throughout the Olivet Discourse, refuting everything Paul would say and do, calling him the wolf in sheep's clothing. And then in his first letter, open letter to future history through Yahochanan in Revelation as he speaks to the first community, the Ephesians, he labels Paul a false apostle. And Paul's the only person in everything that Yahusha says, condemning of a singular individual, he is the only person who qualifies. And the same thing is true with Yahweh's prophecy regarding Shaul, Paul. There's no one else in human history that even comes within a hemisphere of qualifying. He then says that this man's fixation is going to be against circumcision, which is exactly the fulcrum that Paul chose to attack the Torah. And so on and on it goes. It just identifies every aspect of Pauline doctrine. And God says that it's the plague of death. Paul says that no one who follows him will be satisfied. He tells us that what Paul writes is untrue, unreliable, worthless. So in that context, now God goes into great detail to tell us specifically the ploy that Paul will use. And the ploy that Paul developed was to create his own caricature of Yahusha, now known to Christians as Jesus Christ, that was modeled entirely after Dionysus. Every aspect of the Pauline Jesus Christ is Dionysian. That's because the Pauline attack on the Torah is Gnostic, which was the core, the center, the heart of Greek philosophy and religious perspective, where the flesh is bad and the spirit is good. And so that is the tactic that Paul used. He created a caricature. And the Christian Jesus Christ is a caricature. Doesn't have the right name. Doesn't have the right title. And is wholly disassociated from what he actually said and did, who he actually was and is. It's the Jesus Christ of Christianity is a false god created by man, a caricature. And that's what God is saying here. And it was by creating this caricature on a false pagan god, Dionysus. And Dionysus, by the way, doesn't stand alone. With the Dionysus, there is Osiris. And with Osiris in Egypt, before him, there was Tammuz in Babylon. And Tammuz is modeled after Nimrod or Ninus, the sun. Always the same, a dying and resurrecting god. Celebrating their holy days on what is now Christmas and Easter, Sunday worship, called the Lord. Every aspect of their nature, son of the Father, is played out in the Jesus Christ myth. And Rome, it was Bacchus. So it's exactly what he did. And Paul wove a web of lies around this caricature that he had created of the Christian Jesus Christ that was a veiled form of a pagan god for one reason, and that was to draw attention to, claim for, partiality to Paul. And Paul is a grotesquely insecure man, which is why he had the flaming ego. As a grotesquely man dealing with inferiority issues, did what all insecure individuals do. They tear others down with the thinking that they tear them down. They perceive that everyone is out to get them, and they tear others down to lift themselves up. And that's what Paul did, and that's what this says. It's about adding credence and partiality, believability, to Paul, and also so that the testimony of those that Paul is tearing down is muted. And that's exactly what Paul did. He muted the testimony of Yahuchanan and of Shimon Kesha, Peter, John, Jacob, who's been renamed James, and most importantly, Yahweh through Yahusha. He muted their testimony. He either, in the case of Yahusha, never quoted him. And in the case of Yahweh, every time he quoted him, he misquoted him and took what he said out of context and claimed that God said exactly the opposite of what he actually conveyed, thereby muting their actual and accurate testimony. There is no better depiction, no more accurate and telling, insightful depiction of Pauline Christianity than this statement. I'm going to read it for you. How does he succeed with a caricature? Or why does he benefit by valuing an idolatrous image shaped in such a way? Indeed, he will construct him, fashioning him, fabricating and devising him by offering a veiled form of a pagan god, by forming an alliance which conceals an association with hides, covering up the true identity, and by teaching lies through deceptive, misleading, mistaken, and useless instruction, so that he adds credence and partiality to the one that created this construct of him. For him to make the shepherds bound and moot, negated, appearing dumb. Who are the shepherds? Yahusha is the ultimate shepherd. Yahweh appointed his disciples as shepherds. Those of us who are part of Yahweh's family, who come to know him, to understand his Torah, to engage in his covenant, to the extent that we are able, we also serve to shepherd Yahweh's sheep, to nurture them, to protect them, to guide them. All of this was bound and mooted by Paul and his letters and his attacks. It is as brilliant, as accurate, as pertinent, as profound a prophecy as any that can be found anywhere in Yahweh's testimony. This is a comprehensive indictment against the very tactic that was used to create Christianity. A false name, a false title, a false individual, and attributing all manner of pagan traditions to him. All concocted in a web of lies for the singular purpose of elevating the fame of one Paul, Saul of Tarsus. And the result? Billions of people have lost their souls. Billions of people have been beguiled. That's why this is the most important prophecy ever stated. We'll be back. The next statement in Chabaouk, this Chabaouk, the conclusion of 18 and 19, is, woe to the one who says to the wooden pillar, approaching the upright timber, return from the dead, rising up to build by providing false testimony and precluding further observation, and to the rock. He consistently teaches, be silent and moot. Behold, he has actually been seized, captured, and then covered. Brilliantly shimmering, extremely valuable and desirable, but without any spirit in his midst. This is an interesting perspective here. The etz, which is the wooden timber, is used prophetically throughout the Torah and prophets and Psalms to associate the doorway upon which the blood of the Passover lamb was sprinkled during the first celebration of Passover. The wood that was under and carried up Mount Moriah, upon which Yishak was laid at the time that the covenant was confirmed with Yahweh, where Yahweh provided the lamb on top of that wooden pyre. The idea that the center post, the Edon, the upright pillar, which was of wood, in the tabernacle was used to make the tent secure, the home of the tent of the witness secure, but also to make it so it could be expansive. You know, if you don't have the upright pillar in the middle, it's just a piece of sheeting on the ground. And so the Edon, it's always in the Torah spoken of as that wooden timber that's set into the foundation of the tabernacle and temple that holds it up, enlarges it, makes it secure. And it's the uprights on the doorway to salvation that the blood of the sacrificial lamb is sprinkled during the first Passover. And it's upon an upright pole of wood, the etz that prophetically we read in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, that Yahushua would fulfill Passover. And so it is on this upright pillar that we're talking about Paul's doctrine differing from the truth. You see, Yahushua didn't rise from the dead because God cannot die. But yet that's what Paul claims, is that his Jesus Christ overcame death. That's not true. Only the physical body died as the sacrificial lamb. The soul did not die. The soul went into Sheol, place of separation. And then there was no return from the dead since God did not die, but instead a release from Sheol and a reunification of soul and spirit, the spirit of Yahweh, the only thing that made the man a diminished manifestation of Yahweh here on earth. The set-apart spirit departed the corporeal manifestation upon that upright pillar so that God, A, would not die, and B, so that God could not go to the place of separation from God, Sheol, which, by the way, is named after Paul. Paul, Shaul, and Sheol are spelled identically in Hebrew. So God is saying that when you create a religion based upon this concept of return from the dead, then, and you don't, and you discourage further observation and thoughtfulness, examination, that's where you create the biggest concern. Woe is a concerning term. So he's telling us further that this construct and this caricature that Paul would create would fixate on the wooden pillar. There is no Hebrew word for cross. There was no cross even in the eyewitness accounts. It's an upright pillar. Sturo is a upright pillar. It was changed by Roman Catholics to a cross because Rome would later use a cross to crucify, but the crucifixion actually took place on an upright pillar, not on a Christian cross. And so Paul took that and what occurred on the upright pillar, created this myth that God had died, and then he precluded people from further observation. And therein, people lose 100% of the intel needed to make a good choice. So this is one, woe to the one who says to the wooden pillar, the upright one. This is, and that's one of the things, too, that you need to know. And this one of why I wanted to share this this concept of Edon and how it's related to the upright pillar and how in the Torah, the Edon, the upright one, is always the wooden pillar that holds up the tent of the witness, the center of it. And it's why the upright pillars of the doorway to the home were sprinkled with the lamb's blood on Passover. And it's why Yahushua is depicted prophetically in enduring the Passover sacrifice on an upright pillar. And he, as a diminished corporeal physical manifestation of Yahweh, is the upright one, the Edon. And so this is saying that he is taking the upright one in the pillar from which he fulfilled Passover and said that he's returning from the dead and then precluding additional thought regarding that. And there is where Christianity goes awry. I mean, that is really where it happens, right there. This notion that God died for their sins. Now, imagine that. Imagine a religion that becomes the most popular religion in the world that had the created kill their creator. I mean, huh? You know, they want to talk about God being immortal, God being eternal, and yet he was killed. How is that possible? Of course, it's not possible. It's ridiculous. That's why this prophecy even says earlier that, God, you're immortal. You cannot die. But Pauline Christianity is based on the death of God in association with that upright pillar, which Christians later turned into a cross. And when they preclude further observation, then what you get is a religion based on beliefs that cannot and are not true. You know, for example, you just look at the evidence. If you want to be observant, you will recognize that the Passover lamb is represented by the body of Yahusha. And that explains why the spirit of Yahweh had to leave. That's why he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which Christians could never understand because they think the totality of God is on their cross. Well, no. God left him. The set apart spirit departed. Christians haven't a clue what that means. But if you're observant, if you throw off the Pauline mandate not to be observant and you become observant, you'll understand why the set apart spirit left on the upright pole. You understand the testimony. Then you'll understand why Yahweh speaks of having a soul throughout the prophets. And then you'll understand what the Psalm 22 represents and why Yahusha quoted it when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? It is the eyewitness account of what is happening and will continue to occur during the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkotim. All you have to do is be observant. Read it. Think about it. And there's a vivid depiction, not only in Psalm 22, but also in Psalm 88, regarding the nature of what would occur on that pole and what the physical consequences were to the physical body, but then how the soul would go to the place of separation to be tormented by HaSatan and his demons and then be released and to be reunited with the light, which is the depiction of the set-apart spirit. And then you understand why this occurred. Matzah was fulfilled on the Shabbat. And you understand that Yahweh tells us explicitly that the body of the Passover lamb that is not consumed as food, that isn't nourishing, that part must be eliminated during the night, burned up in the fire. That's why there was no physical body. The physical body, Yahweh fulfilled the Torah's promises perfectly regarding the physical body, was destroyed that night. And that is the reason the eyewitness accounts all say that no one recognized him. There's four depictions of what occurred on or post-Bukkotim, and every one of those depictions is identical. No one recognized him. Entirely different body. He is now a spiritual construct and could transition from spirit to matter as he saw fit, when he saw fit, where he saw fit. Every aspect of what we have available to us makes perfect sense when it's observed from the proper perspective, from that of the Torah, from that of the Psalms, from that of the prophets. And then the eyewitness testimony is exactly as it must be. All of it makes perfect sense, but Paul precluded further observation. It's just, why even, first of all, he demeaned the Torah, so there's no reason for Christians to look there. He said the Torah can't save. Torah was replaced. He has the Torah being nailed to the cross. Well, at least according to Christians. And so, the Christians don't think, and he created a religion based upon faith. Faith is what happens when you don't know and when you don't think. When you don't understand, you have to believe. And so there's no reason to think. There's no reason to be observant if faith is what's all that's required. Therein is the problem. The rock who was Yahusha, the rock who is Shimon Kephesh, are therefore ignored. and yet is the rock of our salvation, whose teachings are now silenced because of what Paul wrote. But I, Paul, say, Yosef's Sermon on the Mount is never considered by Christians because it's wholly and completely incompatible with Pauline doctrine. Yosef's Olivet Discourse isn't considered because it's wholly and completely incompatible with Pauline doctrine. Yosef's Revelation Open Letters aren't considered because they're wholly and completely incompatible with Pauline doctrine. In fact, in each case, Paul is the person that Yosef is accusing of malfeasance. But Christians don't cite Yosef's or Yosef's testimony. They cite Paul's. Paul silenced them. He plastered over. His caricature, his false teaching, was plastered right on top of the truth. That's what a counterfeit does. That's why it's so deadly. It's why it's so misleading, is that Paul didn't create his own construct. No. He plastered over. He corrupted Yahweh's teaching. That's what makes him credible. So this does say that the nature of Paul is that Paul would be seized. He would be captured and controlled by a brilliantly shimmering entity. One that was seen as valuable and desirable, but without the Spirit in his midst. Paul's claim of what he saw on the road to Damascus was exactly as Yosha said that he saw Satan falling from heaven. It is exactly what Satan looks like, brilliantly shimmering. And the line that Paul quoted, of course, attributed to that flashing light, was Dionysus' most famous line, "It's difficult to kick against the goad," meaning it's difficult to rebel and to oppose a popular religion. So that's the explanation. Yahweh is precise. He tells us everything we need to know. Paul repeatedly stated that the wooden pillar, more commonly known as the Christian cross today, exists as the means to be awakened from the dead, to be resurrected in religious parlance. He equates sleep with death and speaks of those who were sleeping rising abruptly. So this is an allusion to Pauline's fixation on the wooden cross, from which he promotes resurrection from the dead, thereby dismissing Pesach, Matzah, Bekodim, and Shavuah, in addition to Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah. Paul's plan begins and ends with the cross and with the death of his God. In the most favorable light, what comes next, had it been set into a different context, might have been designed to reflect the Shamar, observational view of the Torah. Many, if not all, of its instructions are vastly more valuable when we study and understand them than they are to us when we habitually do them, irrespective of their intent. In this regard, the symbolism of circumcision is even more important than the act of circumcision, although both are essential to our ability to respond to and engage in the covenant relationship with God. I think that ultimately there are very few instructions that Yahweh provides to us where understanding and doing are equally important, are both required, if you will. You know, the terms and conditions of the covenant, understanding and acting upon them, each is inseparable. Does you no good to understand the condition if you don't act upon it? Walking away from Babylon, from religion and politics. Choosing to trust and rely upon Yahweh, which means you need to know him and understand what he's offering. walking to Yahweh to become perfect, which is answering the invitations to meet with him seven times a year, these very days that we've just delineated. Observing the terms and conditions of his covenant so you understand what they are, so that you're in a position to respond intelligently to them, and circumcising our sons. The circumcision is one where Yahweh goes right to the heart of the issue. He says, I don't want you to be misled here. You must be circumcised of the spirit and of the flesh. Spirit means you understand the concept of circumcision and what it represents. And of the flesh means you, as a man, you are circumcised if you want to participate in the covenant, if you want to participate in the benefits associated with Passover, which is eternal life, and if you want to enter God's home. And it's one of the few places where God says, I want to be abundantly clear here. So there's absolutely no misunderstanding. You need to observe this in such a way that you act upon it, both understanding its spiritual implications and physically do what I'm requesting. And that is the case with circumcision. We'll be back. As we shall see, with Yahweh, male circumcision is a life and death decision, one which he is unwilling to compromise. Therefore, my point is simply that we should seek to understand all of Yahweh's instructions regarding life in the covenant, and then respond rationally based upon what we have learned. And in the case of circumcision, there is no wiggle room. And it is an absolute, unequivocal statement. If you are a man and you are not circumcised, you cannot be part of the covenant, which means you can't be saved, you can't engage in a relationship with God. If you are not circumcised, you cannot participate in Passover, which means there's no means to eternal life. And if you're not circumcised as a man, you cannot enter God's home. No heaven. Absolutely, unequivocally precluded. And before you say, well, you know, that's just mean. No, there's five terms and conditions of the covenant. If you want to participate in the covenant, those are the five terms and conditions. No wiggle room on those. You either come to know Yahweh and decide that you want to spend eternity as part of his family, and you come to understand what he is providing by way of the covenant and what he is asking of us, and you respond to each of those five terms and conditions consistent with the way that they are delineated, or you don't become part of his family. You can't be saved. That's just it. It's his home. It's his rules. That's what he established. Now, I think that each of the statements that he makes is brilliant. I think that each of the five requirements is uplifting, liberating, empowering, enriching, universal benefit. Matter of fact, we've done programs where our listeners have stated, and I concur with them, that while there are five specific conditions to participate in the covenant and five very specific benefits of the covenant, the fact is that all five conditions of the covenant are also benefits. We benefit by accepting those terms and conditions. We benefit when we walk away from religion and politics from Babylon. We benefit when we trust and rely on Yahweh. We benefit when we walk to God to become perfect by way of the Moed Mikre, the invitations to meet with God and be called out of this world. We benefit when we study, closely examine, and carefully consider the terms and conditions of the covenant. We even benefit by circumcision. And so, all of the terms and conditions of the covenant are actual benefits, as are the benefits which are on Pesach, he makes us immortal. On Matzah, he makes us perfect. On Bukurim, he adopts us into his family as his children. On Shavuah, he enriches and empowers us. Now, there are three more Moed Mikre that have yet to be fulfilled that also provide benefits. And they are Teruah, which means to as a member of Yahweh's family, as a beneficiary of these first four called out assembly meetings being fulfilled, enriched and empowered, adopted and immortal, that we're encouraged to share what we know, to talk about the family, to tell people about Yahweh, to do what we're doing right here. That's the purpose of Teruah. And then on Yom Kippurim will be fulfilled in year 6,000, on October 2nd, as the sun sets in Jerusalem, is when Yahweh will return to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael. And then, 5 days later, on Sukkah, we'll begin a 1,000-year celebration of God camping out with us here on earth. That's the story. That's the path. That's the plan. All benefits to us, all extraordinarily important for us to understand and for us to act upon. Now, these things, no, Paul's statement is misleading. In fact, without the proper perspective, it's counterproductive. He says, to the contrary, not even Titus, a Greek, being, was compelled to be circumcised. So what he's saying is that, you know, he went to the Jerusalem summit. He was compelled to go there by Paul. And he says, you know, the whole issue, of course, was circumcision. That's what he's admitting here. The whole problem was circumcision. And they did not compel Titus, who was a Greek, to be circumcised. And that sounds like, okay, so they capitulated on circumcision. No, it doesn't. That's not what it means at all. What it means is that those who know Yahweh as Shimon Kephesh, the rock dead, Peter, as I do, those of us who know Yahweh recognize we don't compel anybody to do anything. Yahweh won't even compel us. We're asked, and we have the opportunity to respond. We'll pick this up at this point in our program tomorrow. May God bless you all.